Welcome to the teaching ministry of North Coast Church in Vista, California. Pit Stop Christianity, where the rubber meets the road, is the title of this multi-part series where each message will look at the nuts and bolts needed to get around life's track. So open your Bibles to Ephesians and join with us as Pastor Chris Brown begins today's message.
Yeah, any NASCAR fans? No? I just want to go fast after watching that. I mean, it's become the largest single sporting event in weekends right now in America. And you got all those cars lined up. Everybody's packed in there. All the colors, all the decals, all the numbers. Every car weighing 3,400 pounds. Every car the exact same. Their makes are a little bit different, but you can't tell them apart just by looking at them. 200.7 inches long, 51 inches high, 3,400 pounds. Like I said, every engine is going to be broken down and rebuilt after every race. There's 36 templates that go over every car to make sure every car is the same. No one's cheating on that thing before they get out on the track. That engine putting out almost 800 horsepower, going 200 miles an hour in the straightaway, 185 miles an hour into the corners. Oh yeah, it's exciting. I just want to drive fast talking about it. It's NASCAR. It's blown up big time. And weekend after weekend, we're in a place where we get to watch it, and cars just racing, going as fast as they can, absolutely nowhere. Always turning left, never turning right, and that's NASCAR. And for whatever reason, it's developed this national following that's just huge. And yet it all comes down to a scene that we just saw, pit stops. Every driver, every crew chief, every owner will tell you, man, that's what they're on, pit stops. The amount of work that has gone into pit stops and redefining and refining what a pit stop is and does. Seven guys have to act in absolute unison. Seven guys wait behind a little wall as that car comes flying in pit row. As that car comes going to about a 29-foot spot, slams in there, 3,400 pounds, comes resting to a stop. 800 horsepower engines now are sitting there just revving, ready to go. RPMs at 9,000, and these guys all jump over the wall, carrying 65-pound tires, 85-pound gas tanks that are going on there, a 39-pound jack that in one pump can lift up the entire side of the car. So two guys will run around, bring the tires of the guys down, lug nuts come off, old tires off, new tires on, lug nuts back on, car will be dropped. If any adjustments need to be made, now's the time to do it. If you think I'm talking fast, you should watch the pit stop. The guy changing the rear tire has a wrench. If the spring needs to be adjusted, he's going to do that. Either tighten or loosen it, because going into the corner, the car was a little too high, the car was a little too low, the aerodynamics wasn't right. The back end was trying to get out ahead a little bit. Those adjustments are made right there on the spot. The front guy's got time to clean any junk that's been gathered in the front air porch just to make sure the intake's all clear. The guys running with the tires, once they've switched them out, have enough time to clean a windshield, give the driver a quick drink, and just make sure that everything on the front of the car is set. More tape needs to be added to the grill, tape needs to be taken off to provide more air into the radiator or to provide better aerodynamics again. And the whole thing's done on the other side. The 39-pound jack guy just picks it up, runs it over, boom, the other side's up. Two more 65-pound tires go on, everything goes off. Guys jump back over the wall, hits the car, takes off, and it's all done in 17 seconds. Woo! 17 seconds? Are you kidding me? 22 gallons of fuel, four tires, everything checked, rechecked, calibrated, ready to go, a quick drink, windshield done, visor done, and boom, back off and onto the track. 17 seconds. Most teams are trying to shoot for that 15-second pit stop. You say, come on, 15 seconds to 17 seconds, it's not a big deal. 15-second pit stop compared to a 17-second pit stop means 200 yards on the racetrack. 200 yards. That's a long way from first place, and, well, kind of glad you came. And it all comes down to that. We didn't know how this was going to go. We're going to have some fun up here. We got a little set that's going to be designed today and throughout the course of the series. Just some engine blocks, some guy junk up there in cars, and I feel cool just standing on a stage like this. Because we want to get into your minds over the next few weeks this idea of a pit stop and what it means. Because regardless of the engine and the body in the car and everything that's been taken care of, those pit stops are so critical to how you run the race. I know they're just a few seconds. I know in comparison to the rest of your week and all that you got going on and the places and the family and the agendas and the work and all the expectations on you, I know your time here today and on our weekends might seem like a relatively short amount of time, but it is so important. And we come to a place in Ephesians where Paul wants to let us know, okay, there's this pit stop Christianity you got to come together on. See, it's in the pit stop all the little nuts and bolts are taken care of. It's in the pit stop that anything that was happening on that track, when it just seemed like you were spinning in circles and going nowhere, any little adjustments need to be made, any attitude changes, any relationship changes that need to be made, any things in our ethics or morality that just needs to be tweaked, we're going to come in here over the next few weeks and look at what Paul's done with that. Look at how Paul puts it out there, and he writes it about as fast as a pit stop. We get in the next like 15 verses and Paul's just like, bzz, 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 and you're like, time out. Let's break them down one at a time. So if you're just joining us, we've been in a series called Theology for Dummies. The first three chapters in Ephesians, Paul has been writing about some phenomenal theological ideas and concepts. And we've just been busting them down to, hey, here's simply what he means. If you want, we're in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 25. But you don't need to turn there because it's only one verse and I put it on your outline. Once again, I know you're saying, we don't do that at North Coast. We use our Bibles. We're going to use our Bibles a lot today. It won't be in Ephesians, but get ready to turn because we're going to go. If you want to take out, though, your little fill-in-the-blank, your note sheet, the only verse in Ephesians we're hitting is this one. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 25, and it's right there on the top. Therefore. Well, I had a professor that always used to say, anytime you come to a therefore, you must stop and ask what it's there for. You've heard that before. Therefore, what's it there for? I'll tell you what it's there for. Therefore, because of everything Paul talked about God buying us, about redemption, about sanctification, about these great big words that basically all we looked at over the last few weeks is, you have a God that has sought you out. You have a God that has given His Son and has bought you. You have a God that has given you everything you need to get around life's track. You have a God that says, you know what? I want to be your owner. I want not just steering wheel of your life, but the entire car. I want you. And because I want to be an owner, start running it my way. And let me show you how much more you can get out of your life. He then got into chapter 4. And Paul started talking about we all are one body. We're one family if you're a follower. And last week I talked about transformation. Remember that? Put off the old way of thinking before you came to God. Change the way. You got to think differently. And now you got to put on a new life. And now we start that putting on. Every weekend, we're going to take another verse. Every weekend, we're going to take another idea and break it down. What is Paul saying to put on? So congratulations, you're here. You've rolled into the pit stop today. You're sitting here, and we're ready to go. And the very first thing we want to talk about is truth. Ephesians 4, verse 25. It's right there on the top of your note sheet, and it says this. Therefore, because of all that we just covered, and last week talking about you have to be different, each of you must put off falsehood and speak truthfully to his neighbor, for we are all members of one body. And that's it. And Larry said, Chris, you're doing another week. You're back to back. And I'm like, all right, what passage? He goes, here's your verse. And I'm all, a verse? I could talk for about 2 hours on a verse. I don't know if it would make any sense. But a verse, I like stories. I like passages. He's like, no, we're breaking this thing down. We're going to be talking about truth in here. We're going to be talking about anger in here. We're going to talk about morality in here. We're going to talk about work and worth at work at yeah, that big word in here. The way we work. Work ethics in here. We're going to talk about the way we deal with each other over the next few weeks. But it's amazing to me where Paul starts. When Paul wants to come to, okay, if you're going to follow Christ, here's what you need to put on. The first thing he throws out in the pit stop, the first thing he says, get this on, get this bolted together before you take off and do any more laps, he hits this. You got to put off falsehood. No more lies, no more deceit, and you got to speak truthfully with each other because you're all one body. And I thought to myself, Paul, out of all the areas you could have started, why there? You know, go after some big things in my life. Not just, yeah, we'll work on the lies or the deceit, but I mean, what are the major things that I got to work on? And Paul says, no, we start there. He'll do the same thing in chapter 6. I know we'll get to it someday down the road, but in chapter 6, when he talks about putting on the full armor of God, the very first thing he says you need to put on is a belt that he refers to as truth. Once again, we start with truth. When he's writing Timothy in 4:12, he lets Timothy know, look, don't let anyone look down on you because of your youthfulness, but set an example to everyone else by your, and the very first thing he mentions is speech. And then your love, and then your faith, and then he gets to all the things, but the very first thing, your speech. Your integrity, your truthfulness. Paul, I think, wants to get us through his messages. Hey, there's a lot of things all of us need to work on in the Christian life. But if our truthfulness isn't there, if our honesty isn't there, no matter what else we do, no one's going to listen because our reputation and our integrity shot. So you've slammed in here today, and the very first thing we're going to hit is simply that thing, truth. And where do you go with it and why? Well, I love the way Paul says, listen, here's why you need to listen to today. Many of you are saying, hey, I'm not a compulsive liar. I don't have a big problem with lying. I'm pretty good on that stuff. Why is this? I wish this had a little bit more to do with me today. And here's why. Don't miss the last part of the verse. In fact, go up and underline it. For we are all members of one body. Paul tries to take us back, doesn't he? Paul tries to take us back and say, remind me why I need this. Because you're all one body. Because when you watch NASCAR, the honesty and the communication has to be there. Your driver is out there on the track at 200 miles an hour, inches from other 3,400-pound vehicles going 200 miles an hour. And when he is telling his crew chief what's going on, he has to be honest. There's no reason to lie about that.
Things are handling good.
It's like, really?
The wheel's in my hand, but I think I can get it back on.
When he's around the track, he's letting them know, we're a little tight here, we're a little loose here, it's pushing here in the corner. He's letting them know. That crew chief then, he's telling those seven guys on the wall to get ready. Here's the things we have to adjust, we have to fix. And they are working as a complete team. An absolute honesty, an absolute integrity, so when you come in, everything gets fixed that needs to be fixed, so that you can get the most out of it again. And that's all Paul is saying. Hey, in our Pit Stop Christianity, here's why I want to start here. Because as believers, as a church, we're in this together. Your integrity and your truthfulness matters to me, just like my integrity and my truthfulness is going to make an impact and matter on you. It's the way it works. And he says, remember, I told you your body. That's why we start here today, because your body. In the same way a pit stop and a crew chief and a driver works together, our bodies work together. I've been given senses. My senses then are going to tell my body what's going on. The nerve endings are going to relay that to the brain, and then my brain's going to relay to the rest of the body what I need to do because of what my senses have just packed up. You know that. It started when we were little. Simple things, like fire. Woohoo! That's not going to mean much. I just want to play with fire in church, so I brought it out. And little, you start learning about what's hot and what's not hot. And as soon as your hand gets in, your body's like, ooh, take that away. Why? Because it's honesty. My hand's letting me know, dude, that's hot. Don't do that. The nerves are going up and the brain's going, hey. And it's like, oh, that works. It has no reason to lie to each other. My senses are telling me, you know what? That's a cold flame this time. Go ahead. Play with the cold flame. Like, oh. It doesn't work where you say, okay, I'll just put my hand over it for a very, very long period of time until it goes out. And just let it go and just let it go and just let it go and just let... Well, of course, it's behind my hand, not under it. Because this would be ridiculous. Because your body would know, no, as a body, we preserve the body. As the body, we work together. As a body, my mind, my senses, and my nerves want to have complete authenticity, vulnerability, and truthfulness to each other. Why? Because it wants to preserve me. It wants to do what's best for Christ. So Paul writes, here we go, church. The first thing, being a believer, putting off old ways of doing things, your falsehood. The ways we used to be deceitful with each other, the ways we used to cover things up, the way we wouldn't have full disclosure, it's gone. And now here's what I ask for, he says. Truthfulness. With the way you deal with each other. So a couple stories we're going to look at. If you got your Bible ready to go, we're going to be in Genesis. I like it when we do that because it's easy to find that book. Very first one in the Bible. Very first book in the Bible. We're in Genesis 12, verse 1. And it starts like this. So the Lord had said to Abraham, leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land that I will show you. I'm going to make you into a great nation, and I'm going to bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. Wow, I love this. I love the call of Abraham. I love the beginning of the family of God, where God shows up and said, it's now time for me to create my people, a nation called Israel. It's now time to create that group that my Messiah is going to come through. And through him, everybody is going to be blessed. And the promise is given to Abraham. Get up, go. And here's the promise I give you. Go to verse 10. Now there was a famine in the land, and Abraham went down to Egypt to live there for a while because the famine was severe. And he was about to enter Egypt, and he said to his wife Sarah, I know what a beautiful woman you are. And when the Egyptians see you, they're going to say, this is his wife? Then they're going to kill me, but they're going to let you live. So say you are my sister, so that I will be treated well for your sake, and my life will be spared because of you. How many verses ago was there a great promise about God protecting and being with them and providing, and out of him will become a great nation? And the very first thing we have from Abraham is, I think they're going to kill me. I think my life's going to be over. No, you're beautiful. Abraham's the guy that realized he married way out of his league. Some of us guys are fortunate to be like that. All of us guys are fortunate to be in that place. I meant some of us, those that aren't married, aren't fortunate yet to be in that place. Anyway, back to the Bible. And he realized that. I'm one of those guys that walk around and realize that. I'm one of those guys that go to the mall with Amy and guys look at her and look at me and like, huh? And I was like, and so he takes off. He goes to Egypt and he realizes, man, Sarah, she is beautiful. And the Egyptians, they see that and they're going to kill me to take my wife. Say you're my sister. Verse 14. So when Abram came to Egypt, the Egyptians saw that she was a very beautiful woman. And when Pharaoh's officials saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh, and she was taken into his palace. And he treated Abram well for her sake, and Abram acquired sheep and cattle, male and female donkeys, men servants and maid servants, and camels. And he lost his wife. And Pharaoh's got a new one. Abraham, what?
I got a couple donkeys for a sheep.
And it's like, now lies can momentarily seem like they're paying off, but imagine that conversation. Imagine that day they show up knocking on the door. Hey, Abram, right? Yeah. A new in town? Yeah. We know it's your sister. Pharaoh's going to take her as a wife. That's okay with you. Sis? And you know, Sarah's behind the door. Don't you better tell him who I am. Don't. And it goes. I can't imagine. I can't imagine as a husband the day watching your wife being taken away to be someone else's wife and you're standing there waving, pretend like she's your sister.
We're not going to imagine.
Verse 17. So the Lord inflicted serious diseases on Pharaoh and his household because of Abram's wife, Sarah. So Pharaoh summoned Abraham. What have you done to me? He said, why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Or why didn't you tell me that she was your wife? Yeah. Why did you say she's my sister? So that I took her to be my wife. Now then, here's your wife. Take her and go. Pharaoh's whole house gets plagued with stuff. And he's like, what's going on? And he finds out the sister you took is actually his wife. And I guess he's a holy guy or something like that. And put oh, imagine that conversation. Imagine Sarah coming back. I don't know how many days it's been. Maybe it was just that one day. But she's taken away. She's in this foreign country. She's becoming a wife to this greatest ruler of the time in the known world, a Pharaoh. And she's got to be sitting there wondering, what in the world did we just get ourselves into? You know the moment she's back home and that door is shut, there's a conversation that has to be had. I guarantee you, Abram never, ever does a move like this again. Turn to chapter 20. It's going to be a few pages to your right. I love the way the Bible is so honest with its people and its heroes, aren't you? I love this. It gives me hope. Not to do anything like this, but I mean, just gives me hope. Genesis 20, verse 1. Now Abraham, and he said, whoa, is this the same guy? It's spelled different. Abraham. God changed his name from just exalted father to now it's going to be a father of a great nation. Sarah's name is going to be changed a little bit too to make her now into princess. And it's a name change that happens. It's, remember name's identity? And God wants you to know, look, when you come to me and you make me Lord of your life, your identity is going to change also. So it happened quite a bit at this time. Abraham and Sarah, now we have it the way it's pronounced and spelled. And now Abraham moved on from there into a region of the Negev and lived between Kadesh and Shur. And for a while he stayed in Gerar. And there Abraham said of his wife Sarah, she's my sister. And then Abimelech, the king of Gerar, sent for Sarah and he took her to be his wife. Sound a little familiar? Guys, we're just guys. Verse 3. So God came to Abimelech in a dream one night and said to him, you are as good as dead because of the woman you have taken. She's a married woman. Now, I love his response. I love the king's response here. Verse 4. Now, Abimelech had not gone near her, so he said, Lord, are you going to destroy an innocent nation? Did he not say to me that she's my sister? And didn't he also say he is my brother? I have done this with a clear conscience and clean hands. So God said to him in the dream, yes, I know you did this with a clear conscience. And so I've kept you from sinning against me. In other words, he hasn't touched her yet. That is why I did not let you touch her. Oh, it just said that. Verse 7. Now return the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you will live. But if you do not return her, you may be sure that you and all yours will die. Abraham, what are you doing? Okay, the first time I understand, it was just your life on the line, and maybe, but now you're squared away. Now you're walking with God, and you get back into a jam, and what do? She's my sister. And there's a little bit of truth here. If you follow the linealogy, the birth things at that time, yeah. Genealogy, lineage and genia, yeah. If you follow the birth things at that time, you're going to find out what's going on there. She is a half-sister. And so he told a half-truth. And yet the Bible wants to make it clear, look, a half-sister and a half-truth, it's still going to equal a lie. It's still equaling deceit. And yet Abraham, like so many of us, there's a way to compromise that, isn't there? Well, I told partial truth. I mean, she is technically kind of my sister, at least half-sister. I didn't mention the ring part that was going on, but, you know, you could understand why. Isn't it amazing how much we can compromise in life? Isn't it amazing how much we can get into a situation and pray for God, and God comes and delivers, and this next time we get in that same situation, we go right back to ourselves again? Here's another guy. Turn to the right. A few more. Genesis 37. Genesis 37. We're looking at three stories here, just dealing with lying, dealing with deceit, dealing with not being truthful. Genesis 37 is one of my favorite stories in the Old Testament. You got a guy named Jacob who had all these boys, and Joseph is the second youngest and his favorite, the coat of many colors he's given him. Joseph, at the age of 17, starts having dreams that he's going to become great. And the first thing he does in the morning is get up and shares it with his brothers around breakfast. I had a dream that all of you were going to bow down and worship me. If you got 11 brothers and you're the second littlest, probably not a good way to start the day. But he's 17, and like a lot of us when we're younger, it's focused just on who am I going to be and where am I going in life. And he hasn't realized yet this calling of God, obedience and humility and walking and giving ownership over. Well, he has another dream, and he's the same thing, except this dream, both mom and dad and all the brothers bow down. So the brothers are starting to have a lot of animosity. Your dad's favorite. You got special gifts. You're talking like that. We also find out that Joseph went out in the fields and spied on his brothers one day and came back and gave his dad a bad report that they weren't doing what they were supposed to do. Yeah, you can see what's building in this home. Father sends him off to the fields again. Go find out where your brothers are and how they're doing with the livestock. And so Genesis 37:19. When they see him a far way off, here's what they say. Here comes that dreamer, they said to one another. Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of the cisterns, one of the wells, and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams. A little dysfunctional family? Coming from the patriarchs of the nation of Israel going on here? When Reuben, the oldest brother, by the way, 21, in verse 21, when Reuben heard this, he tried to rescue him from their hands. Let's not take his life, he said. Don't shed any blood, but throw him in the cistern here in the desert. But don't lay a hand on him. Reuben said this to rescue him from them and to take him back to his father. So here Reuben gets the whole deal. Dude, you can't kill little brother. Why am I here? Dad's going to kill me. Killing little brother is probably not the best way to handle a family dispute. Hey, just put him in a well, but don't kill him. Having in mind, okay, when everyone's gone, I'll get him out of the well. I'll take him back home and just tell him, look, don't come out alone anymore. Well, unfortunately, the story doesn't go that way. Verse 23. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the richly ornamented one that he was wearing, and they took him and threw him into the cistern. And now the cistern was empty. There was no water in it. And as they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. And Judah said to his brothers, what are we going to gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay a hand on him. After all, he is our brother. Our own flesh and blood. Oh, compassion, it comes out. And all of his brothers agreed. Why kill him? We can get something for the guy. So when the Midianite merchants came by his brothers, they pulled him up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him to Egypt. And when Reuben returned to the cistern and saw that Joseph was not there, he tore his clothes and he went back to his brothers and said, the boy isn't there. Where can I go now? And then they got Joseph's robe. They slaughtered a goat, dipped it in blood. And they took the ornamented robe back to their father and said, we found this. Examine it to see whether it's your son's robe. He recognized it and said, it is my son's robe. Some ferocious animal has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces. And Jacob tore his clothes, put on sackcloth, and mourned for his son for many days. Way to go, Reuben. It's not that Reuben was lying. Reuben's withholding truth. Reuben knows what's right, and he's not going to do it. James is clear about that. Anybody that knows the good he or she ought to do, and you don't do it, that's a sin also. See, it's not just the things we say that are untruthful. Sometimes our silence can be just as untruthful. You ever thought about that? Reuben's in a place where he knows what he should do. He speaks enough to kind of get his way around the crowd. But in the midst of that, he ends up losing a brother and he ends up breaking a father's heart. There's a story you're going to get in your growth group homework, 2 Samuel chapter 12, where David has sinned and Nathan comes. And Nathan's the guy that doesn't pull punches. Nathan's the guy that comes right to David. You're the guy that's sinning. I know you're the king. I know you could have my head for this. But look, it's got to be said. You're blowing it here. Only if Reuben had that kind of integrity. Only if Reuben, in the midst of his co-workers, brothers at that time, could have stood up and said, look, I know the right thing to do, and here's what we're going to do. Paul's right in saying, here's why we need truth. Because as a body, we have to function in such a way that every member is going to be cared for, that every member is going to be spoken truth to, that every member knows I can come here and might not always be good. I might not always walk out with warm fuzzies, but I know I'm going to be dealt with truthfully. And I know in the long run, this is what I need. Another story. Turn to Acts. Acts 5, last one we look at. New Testament. Now you got to turn all the way to the back. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Acts, Romans. Acts 5. There's already been the death and resurrection. Christ has returned back to glory. Jesus has gone back to prepare rooms for us, as he said, his disciples. He's left the guys now to do the work. Some amazing things are happening. There's a thing called the Day of Pentecost where they start teaching in different languages and everybody that comes is hearing the gospel in their own language out of one tongue. There's another thing that happens where Peter and John go to the court and they find a man who's been crippled since birth and they heal him in front of everybody and everyone sees. And so this new church, this new following of this guy Jesus is starting to spread in amazing ways. One of the things that hallmarks them is that they're selling everything they have and they're pulling it all together and they're sharing equally. Your house is my house. Your bank account is my bank account. All my possessions are your possessions. Anything you need, I take care of. And nobody is going in need. Nobody's doing without because the church is acting like a church. Well, we got a story in here. At the end of Acts chapter 4, a guy named Joseph comes up, sells everything he has and gives it to the church, a piece of property and gives it to the church. And you know there's got to be that, oh, wow. Joseph just sold out that huge acreage piece of land and gave it all to us. And now it all belongs to us. So in chapter 5, we have another couple that sees what's going on in the church and decides to jump on in on the bandwagon. And now a man named Ananias, 5:1, together with his wife Sapphira, also sold a piece of property with his wife's full knowledge. He kept back part of the money for himself, but brought the rest and put it at the apostles' feet. And Peter said, Ananias, how is it that Satan has so filled your heart that you have lied to the Holy Spirit and have kept for yourself some of the money you received from the land? Didn't it belong to you before it was sold? And after it was sold, wasn't the money at your disposal? What made you think of doing such a thing? You have not lied to men, but to God. Ananias and Sapphira realized we got some property we're not using either. Let's sell it. We saw what happened when Joseph brought it. I mean, everyone knows Joseph sold that property. But they keep a little to themselves. And that's not the sin. Peter wants to say that. It was your money. You could have done anything you wanted with that money. The sin was coming saying, yeah, we sold it for this much. That's the total price. This is the total price. We're giving it all to the new church. And Peter says, look, why are you doing that? God gave Peter that time the wisdom and the knowledge just to understand this guy's lying. He's blatantly lying in front of the whole church. And so Peter calls him on it. And check out verse 5. When Ananias heard this, he fell down and died. Well, that would end some of our problems today, wouldn't it? We wouldn't worry about church growth if we dealt with lies that way. I wouldn't be up here teaching, that's for sure. I'd have been laying down on the ground years and years ago somewhere. I don't know why it happened. Maybe great fear took me at a heart attack. It was a movement of God that said, look, the church is small at this time. We don't need deceitful people in a brand new startup church thing. Whatever reason, Ananias hears it and he falls down and dies. Now, here's where it gets even weirder. When Ananias heard this, he died, middle of verse 5, and great fear seized all who heard what was happening. You think? And then the young man came forward and wrapped up his body and carried him out and buried him. About 3 hours later, his wife came in looking for him, not knowing what had happened. And Peter asked her, tell me, is this the price that you and Ananias got for the land? Yes, she said, that's the price. And Peter said to her, how could you agree to test the spirit of the Lord? Look, the feet of the men who buried your husband are at the door. And they're going to carry you out also. At that moment, she fell down at his feet and died. And then the young men came in and, finding her dead, carried her out and buried her beside her husband. And great fear seized the whole church and all who heard about these events. This wasn't a story they told me in Sunday school. Might have changed the way I dealt with parents a little bit if they were to push this one kind of harder. And yet the story isn't about, hey, you lie, you're going to drop dead, because we know that's not true. The story is about the way God sees deceit and lies within the church, within the body. Again, it's not that they kept money for themselves. They could have kept it all. It would have been fine. The role was them lying in front of the whole church saying, hey, we're giving you everything we have. Really? We know about the Swiss account. Oh, kaboom. And God says, look, especially at the beginning with the new church where it was so critical to make sure that with such small numbers, we had people in there that were like-minded and truth-telling. We can't have people like this part of the congregation. So three stories, three events, Old Testament, New Testament. Why'd they lie? Why do we lie? If you got your note sheet, you want to start making marks and follow around. The first reason why we lie, to avoid pain, don't we? To get out of a jam, because there's a problem and it's like, I know I can get out of this. You know the guy with the lights on his car when they pull you over? Some of us aren't really good at truth-telling at that time. You got a reason to be going this fast? Oh, I know I can come up with a reason to be going this fast. Yeah, I'm probably... Oh, hey, you go to North Coast. Good to see you. We lie to get out of a jam. We lie to make sure that we avoid pain. To keep our job, for title, for position, to make sure that we're the next in line to get that open spot. To cover up, to get out of jam. Second reason we lie. And by the way, don't we do that taxes? How tough is it to be? Man, I sit down with the person that does taxes. She's like, oh, you know what? We can do this and this. And I'm like, are you sure? Oh, yeah. And I'm like, no, I know we can do that. But is it okay if we do that? Oh, yeah. I'm like, no, I know it's okay if we do that. Can I still have integrity before everybody? And she's like, Chris, it's okay. We can do this. I'm like, okay. I'm scared to death. Those things are going to come back and haunt me. Because it seems to me, not being very knowledgeable about that, there are so many ways. There are so many ways to get around. I know we just passed the tax season where it's all kind of fresh in our minds. There are so many ways to avoid different things. And is a loophole really a loophole? Is a loophole okay thing? Or some things aren't loopholes, but just holes. And should I really be falling into holes here? But it's so easy to lie when we avoid pain. Abraham, who is she? She's my sister. What are you facing? Maybe death? Abraham, in reality, what have you forgotten? I forgot in verse 2 and 3 that God promised to make me into a great nation, that he was going to go before me, and that those who curse me are going to be cursed, and those that honor me are going to be blessed. How many verses ago was that, Abraham? This many. 6. So why do you lie? To avoid pain. It's human nature. I'm raising kids. I'm raising liars. Okay? They come that way. Mom, you know, I don't know. I got a mom that's a liar, a dad that's a liar, great-grandma, grandpa, liar. We're all sinners, all the way down both sides of the family. It's no wonder I got kids that naturally just kind of lie when the stuff is smeared all over their face. Karis, come here. Karis, did you get that off the counter? No. What? It's dripping from your... How do you... To avoid pain? Because you know the consequences, and a lot of times it works and we can get out of it. Second reason we lie, fear rejection. This is big for some of us, isn't it? James 4 says, not to be a friend of the world. And yet so many times, it's so hard. This is the time where silence comes in. I lie not because of the things I say, but in moments like this, I know I should say something, but if I say it, how are they going to look at me? If I stand up in the midst of this conversation, how am I going to be treated? What are they going to say around the water cooler about me? If I say what I know I should say at this time, and it's a lot easier just to remain quiet, it's a lot easier just to go on with it. Again, James, anyone that knows the good he ought to do and doesn't do it, well, that's a sin also. Paul's saying we need truthfulness in our kingdom. We need truthfulness amongst our body. A third reason we lie, social pressure. Social pressure. Reuben, you had the right idea. Reuben, you had the right thought. Reuben, you knew it was wrong, and you knew you needed to take a stand. But Reuben... you just didn't go all the way through, did you? Well, I said enough. I told them not to kill him. It's not my fault they didn't listen. You're the oldest brother, Reuben. You're the one with the title on your desk. You're the one that has the right to say, you know what? I know this is the way we've been doing business. We're not doing business that way anymore. I know these are the answers that are supposed to be on the test, but I'm not studying that way anymore. Social pressure. He's got a little brother that no one likes. All the other brothers are in on it. I don't want to be the outcast. I don't want to be the guy without any friends. None of us want to be there. Another reason we lie. To impress. This is probably my biggest ones. To impress. To make ourselves look better. Next to impress, write down a couple verses. Proverbs 3:34. God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. James 4:10. James 4:10 says, humble yourselves before the Lord, and He will lift you up. Matthew 23:12. Matthew 23:12 says, whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. Whose role is it in your life to exalt you? God's, not yours. I got caught on this one in staff prayer time. We have Tuesdays at 12. The whole staff kind of meets in here in a big circle, and everyone gets together. We have the prayer request of the week. And we just pray. And I didn't, but the men's thing, the real men's breakfast thing, happened this weekend, and we're looking at numbers and what's going on, and I didn't know quite where the numbers were, but they said, we got to pray for it because it seems like it's a lot more than we thought. And I'm like, yeah, 700 guys are showing up. 30 seconds later, Dave Inns walks into the prayer meeting. He goes, hey guys, you want to pray for the real men's breakfast going on this weekend? Because we got signups of 600 right now. And everyone looked at me, and I'm like, I thought it was closer to 1,000. Why do I always pick higher numbers when I talk about stuff like that? Yeah, that's it right there. Why when someone gives me an email that has an answer to something we've been trying to do, I cut and paste it on my own email and send it to everybody so it doesn't forward from... I know. Ooh. Why is that temptation there? Why is it about, look, I can claim this. This makes me look a little bit better. I can just say it this way and it brings attention and recognition to me. This is the one I struggle with. In your growth group this week, you got to look at this list and say, hey, this one really gets me, or this one I don't really have that much problem with, but this one... And mine's to impress. I constantly hear myself saying things, and I'm like, why'd you say it that way, moron? Why'd you say it that way? Well, that makes me sound a little bit 700's better than 600. I got, yeah. Yeah. It's not my job to lift myself up. It's not my job to exalt myself. It's our jobs to walk humbly through life and say, you know what, God's going to exalt me. It's not what the coworkers think. It's not the family's expectations. It's not how the mother-in-law is going to grade you. God lifts up the humble, but He opposes the proud. So these are the reasons why they lied. How do we go about and do it differently? See, I put it underneath there. In all these, we are putting faith in our lies, not in God. Have you ever noticed that? In all of these situations, what we're doing is we're putting faith in our lies, not in God. It's much like Abraham. I look at Abraham and think, buddy, how can you be so thick-headed? 6 verses ago, God laid out everything you need to know about where you're going. And you go and lie because you're afraid of what might happen to you? You go and lie to make sure that you're covered, to get yourself out of a jam because you fear rejection? Abraham, come on. But isn't it that way in our life? Where God said, Chris, you're my son. Where He looks at you and says, you're His son and you're His daughter. Let me take care of your life. Isn't that what Matthew 6 is all about? Don't worry about what you eat or what you wear or where you go. You just seek me first and my kingdom. And let me take care of everything else. If we really believe God's promises, why are we lying to get ourselves out of jams? Why are we lying to cover stuff up? Why are we not being truthful with each other and fearing rejection? Because I got more faith in my ability to get out of a situation than the greater faith it takes to sit back and say, God, let me just be honest here. It's your life. It's your situation I got myself into. And the bottom line, the budget might not be met. And the bottom line, I might lose this account. But the bottom line is I got to have more faith that my obedience to you precedes what you want to do in my life than my lying to cover my own self. It's a faith issue is what we're talking about here. So Paul says, do this. When it comes to how you deal with each other, start doing truth. Start doing truth. And before you butt in, here's some questions you got to ask yourself. She was probably one of the most popular girls in our youth ministry. And just one of those that every time she walked in, just kind of everyone kind of flocked around. She was a social butterfly. She had her finger on everything that was going on and who was dating who and who was in trouble and who was grounded and all that stuff. And as a youth pastor, it's one of those people you just kind of rely on. You need those people. She graduates from high school. It's time for her to leave the group, but she doesn't want to go because it's been family for so many years. And she's like, Chris, I want to come back into your intern program. We'd bring back college students and just intern and run them right through our program and leadership development. And I said, Christine, and all of a sudden all these things come through. Tell her you already got your interns. Tell her you got a thing. Well, she should probably wait a year just so the age limit. Tell her you don't need anybody else. Tell her that you're not looking for that yet. Tell her the process is. And all that's going on is a conversation happens in a parking lot after church one day. And yet looking into her eyes, I realized, you know what? I got to tell her. Christine, I love you to death. I think you're amazing. You've got a couple areas you cannot do ministry with your peers right now. You can't handle some of the information you know. And a lot of it deals with just kind of gossip and just leadership stuff. They don't go together. I think it's best if you work with the younger generation where you're not involved in their lives relationally on a friendship-wise, but more of a mentor-wise, and work on that. I could see she was frustrated. I could see she was hurt. I think it's been a year now, actually about a year ago last month, I've been asked to be in Christine's wedding and do part of it. And at her wedding rehearsal, she comes up, we have a short conversation. And she says, hey, remember a conversation we had about 7 years ago? And I'm like, yeah. And she says, oh, it's time for me to say thanks. You see, Christine up in L.A. now is the youth director in charge of an amazing junior high ministry of several hundred kids. And she is the lead pastor. And she is doing, I'm so proud of Christine. And every time I go up in that area, I hear stories about what she's doing and how she's leading. And it's just, it's phenomenal. And I thought, Chris, why don't we do that more? Because it's easier to cover up. It's hard to speak truth. So before we go speaking truth, some simple questions to ask. Number one, what's your motive? What's your motive for speaking truth into someone's life? If there's something going on in their life and you need to say it, because Paul's saying this isn't just about lying in general. This is also about being a body. Speak truth one to another. Speak truthfully to your neighbor. What's your motive? Is it to point out a sin? Is it to point out they're wrong? Is it to point out that you have a right way? Is it to point out that you've already mastered it? If it's any of those things, then just shh. Keep quiet. Keep walking. If your motive's really to look into someone's eyes and say, you know what, I need to get that person back. My motive in that parking lot that day was to look at Christine and say, I could just whitewash this in a heartbeat. But you know what? I don't know what you're going to do with this, and this might be painful. But here's some truth you need to hear from somebody. Then say it. James will say, man, anyone that goes in and shows a brother the error of his ways is going to cover a multitude of sins. You're going to get somebody out of a trap they might have been clueless to on their own. Second thing, am I going to be heard? Am I going to be heard? In other words, have you earned the right in that person's life to speak to them? Is it someone that you've already invested in? Is that someone that you know well enough that when you say it, they're going to take it? Have you already showed a relationship to them in love that when you say it, they're going to take whether they agree with it or not, they're like, you know what? I appreciate you saying that. Proverbs 26:17 says, one who seizes the dog by its ears is a passerby who meddles in the quarrel, not his own. I like that. Just like a guy that goes out and tries to grab a stray dog by the ears. It's just like a person that meddles in something that's not their business. Don't jump into someone else's business unless you've already loved them to the point and have a relationship to the point that you know truth can now travel over that bridge. Third thing, is it my responsibility? Is it my responsibility here? As a fellow Christian, as a fellow brother or sister, is this an area that I can do? And what's going to help you with my responsibility is this last one. Am I willing to help? Am I willing to help? See, unfortunately, we got a lot of people at times that like to point out the faults and wrongs and speak truthfully about each other, but they're not willing to help. Before you go to someone's life and say, here's something you need to hear, make sure you're willing to say, now, how can I help you with it? With Christine, it was one of those things I can look back and say, you know what, I think I did that one right. And I got so many examples of the ones I did wrong. But with Christine, I knew, you know what, I got your best interest in mind. I really do on this one. With Christine, I knew for the last 4 or 5 years, I've earned the right to be heard here. I know you'll listen. With Christine, it was one of those things that I knew, you know what? I also think I play a role in your life where it's my responsibility. No one else is telling you these things. And it's going to be a tough conversation, but I'm willing to have that. And with Christine, look, I know right now in junior high they need help. I'll talk to my junior high pastor. We can get you in there. We'll plug you in right away. And I think it's a great place for you to start working. And in the midst of that, I'm here. We'll walk alongside and let me know how it's going. Jesus will say this, Matthew 23, 1 through 3. You might want to write that down. Matthew 23, 1 through 3. Jesus said to the crowds and his disciples, "The teachers of the law and the Pharisees, they sit themselves in Moses' seat. So you must obey them and do everything they tell you, but do not do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach. They tie up heavy loads and they put them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to help them." Don't be the type of person that wants to burden someone and point out what's wrong and point out what they're doing without being the type of person that rolls up his or her sleeves and says, "Now let me help. Here's an area I think you're struggling with. Now let me help. Here's a problem I think you're going through. Let me shed some light on that and let me journey alongside of you." And Paul urges, look, for the next few weekends, we're going to come screaming in here. I want you to slam on the brakes. I want you to take it out of drive and just rest for a while. And let's give you different nuts and bolts to put on. And we're going to hit them. The very first verse he hits, you got to be truthful. Because everything else we're talking about is going to have places and times where you know there's someone in your life that's going through it. Or you know you yourself are going through it. And we have got to be a body, a church that comes together and says, "I can say this." And it might not be the most pleasant of conversations, but when I say it in love and your best interest in mind, and I want to walk through it with you, and when you receive it in such a way that says, "You know what? I need that. Help me deal with that." Then the body becomes stronger. When my senses say it's hot, pull away, go, and I do it, I save myself burns. And Paul says your body. So the first thing, before we get into a lot of the nuts and bolts, they're going to help you get back out this week and go around life's track, just in the circles that we all spin in. He says the first thing we got to hit is be truthful to each other. Put out the deceit, put away the half-lies, put away the silence when you know you should be speaking up, and be able to approach people and make sure these questions are answered. Otherwise, you've got a scary dog by the ears. It's not a battle I want to fight. And in the midst of that, the body's going to be healthy and strong. Father, thank you. That today we come and we just hit a verse. That today we come and get to a place where we realize maybe the reason Paul starts off the bat with this is because out of this, this foundation is what everything else is going to build upon. And so God, may today be a day that if we've got areas and places in our life where we haven't been seeking truth, that we stop relying on our own ways, our own deceit, our own lies of getting out of it, and say, "This is your situation. I'm going to rest on your promises. Have faith that you are big enough." And start dealing with people in truth and honesty and love. And out of that, God, may our body be stronger. Out of that, God, may every ligament, may every supporting cast that's in here, God, may everybody that combines to make this unit be able to have a place where we can be vulnerable, open, honest, and know that we are being dealt with truthfully. And in the midst of that, grow together. In Jesus' name, amen.
We hope you've enjoyed today's study from God's Word. For more information, or if you'd like additional copies, please contact us at area code 760-724-6700. Our mailing address is North Coast Church, 1132 North Melrose Drive, Vista, California, 92083. Or visit our website at www.northcoastchurch.com. God bless you and thanks for listening.